This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The Briefing Room is the metaversal entity which allows you and I to understand a big issue with the help of the top experts on the subject in just 28 minutes. This week, Brexit. How's it gone? And how's it going? This month, it's been a year since the UK left the EU. Never mind the shoulds and shouldn'ts, what does the balance sheet of the last 12 months tell us? And projecting forward, what should we expect? Step inside the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, we may have fully left the EU a year back, but still, not everything is settled. In recent days, new rules and regulations have come into force. The briefing room's Ben Carter talked to Maddie Teamont-Jack from the Institute for Government's Brexit team.
From the beginning of this year, all goods that are imported into Great Britain from the EU will now be required to be accompanied with full customs declarations. Up until now, they weren't needed to be lodged at the same time as the import of the good. And then all goods that are of plant or animal origin are required to have a pre-notification certificate when they are imported into Great Britain from the EU.
And the new trading arrangements with the EU kicked in last January, but the government decided to delay full paperwork and checks until now. Why?
Partly because of the COVID situation last January, and they were concerned that there would be too much disruption if they introduced full checks, but also because they were worried that businesses weren't ready. It's worth saying that the decision to delay checks last year also bought the government more time to ensure that their IT systems and also all the infrastructure in the ports were in place by the time that the checks were introduced.
And what impact will these checks have on consumers and businesses?
It slightly depends how ready businesses are for the new paperwork and whether there is some disruption at ports. That might mean that certain goods will take longer to get to the shelves. There are going to be increased costs accompanied with having to fill out this paperwork and also ensure the goods will comply with checks. It might be that some of those additional costs are passed on to the consumer. But it's worth saying that although some new paperwork is required in January, some of the more extensive checks are not coming in until July. And so there's still a bit of a question mark at this stage about what that will look like.
And we've been reading about the reintroduction of the dreaded mobile phone roaming charges. Why are they being reintroduced?
The EU decided to eliminate roaming charges when the UK was a member of the EU. But now that we are no longer, it is possible that roaming charges will be introduced for Brits using their phone in the EU. Some companies have already announced that they are going to reintroduce those charges. So, for example, Vodafone, EE and Three, and others might choose to follow suit. And ultimately, it's a decision for the individual company.
And there are more changes coming in July. What are they?
those are goods of plant or animal origin, so agri-food goods, and they will be required to have full certification and will also be subject to some physical checks as well. And that, again, just adds additional paperwork, but also processes for those goods.
And are businesses ready for those changes?
The government does seem pretty sanguine about businesses preparing for those fuller changes, partly because for a lot of businesses who have been exporting to the EU, they will have already been used to complying with those kinds of checks and also that kind of paperwork. I think that it is worth saying at the same time for much smaller exporters from the EU who haven't had to try and understand these new processes, there is more of a question mark about whether or not they will be ready and also whether or not they're going to be willing to continue to supply the GB market. Ultimately, though, I think we're really going to find out when we get to July and when we see whether or not there is more disruption as that sort of smaller subset of goods has to comply with those much more stringent arrangements.
Maddie Teamont-Jack. There's one nation in the UK where arrangements with the EU have been different from the start. Under the terms of the famous protocol, Northern Ireland remains in the single market, and so it's the goods travelling across the Irish Sea that have been subject to customs checks. A year on, how's that going? Sam McBride is Northern Ireland editor of the Belfast Telegraph and Sunday Independent. Sam McBride, take me back a year. What was the situation regarding trade between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK then?
Well, it was very disrupted. In a word, there were product lines disappearing from supermarket shelves. There were, for instance, no Kellogg's products coming into Northern Ireland for 3 weeks at the start of last year. The Northern Ireland Protocol banned British soil from entering Northern Ireland. So that meant that a bare root apple tree or a fig tree or whatever it might be that somebody here might want to buy for their garden from Yorkshire or Hampshire couldn't cross the Irish Sea. It was completely illegal for that to happen. And yet there was a situation where if it was packed in peat, which is obviously bad for the environment, that was absolutely fine. So there were all sorts of absurdities and frustrations that were coming all at once. And yet at that point, we had the Northern Ireland Secretary of State, Brandon Lewis, really insisting very publicly that there is no Irish Sea border. And you really had this Kafkaesque situation where the government was telling us in Northern Ireland not to believe what our eyes were seeing. Unionists didn't like that for political reasons, for constitutional reasons. They saw this as a betrayal, something that was pushing them further away from Great Britain. That led to a great deal of instability. Some of that manifested itself in rioting in the streets. And really, that has largely died down now, but there remains this lingering political instability.
Now, are shortages still happening? And I should ask you, to the extent that they are, does it really matter?
Some of the companies in Great Britain who had stopped selling to Northern Ireland have restarted that, either because they've got their heads around the new rules, they've worked out how to play the system, or because, very significantly, these so-called grace periods have been extended. For instance, there was meant to have been effectively a medicines border in the Irish Sea beginning around now. That has been again delayed. But if that had gone ahead, it would very much have mattered. It would have meant that people in Northern Ireland would simply not have received some medicines that would have been available in other parts of the UK. So there were, I think, for many people in Northern Ireland, it was about how they saw their identity. If there were people who viewed their identity as British, this seemed to make them, in their estimation, a little bit less British. They weren't quite able to do what people in the rest of the UK were able to do.
What you're suggesting is that the impact in that sense was always likely to be more psychological than economic.
There are practical difficulties if you can't get a product that you want, but it was much more, I think, about identity, about politics in Northern Ireland.
Now, did shortages provide Northern Ireland suppliers with something of a business opportunity? I mean, if stuff wasn't coming in, they could make it and sell it themselves.
Oh, yes, absolutely. There has been a small boom in terms of people who are making a lot of money out of this protocol in Northern Ireland. And it's really quite simple. If you constrict supply from Great Britain for certain products, and whether that's meat or plants or whatever it might be, that then makes an opportunity for local firms and for Irish firms south of the border. Just as an example of this, my local supermarket is Sainsbury's. It's about half a mile from my house. I've shopped there for over a decade. They used to have something like 30 types of honey on their shelves, all sorts from all over the world. After the protocol came in last year, they all vanished and they were replaced by two types of honey in my local supermarket. There was Boyne Valley honey, which comes from the Republic in a jar, in a glass jar, and there was Boyne Valley in a squeezy tube. So that was obviously very good for Boyne Valley. It wasn't necessarily good for me as a consumer, because that means less options for Northern Ireland consumers, less competition, and ultimately, I think, higher prices in the long term.
Now, I suppose theoretically also, it gives Northern Ireland businesses a chance to compete within the European Union market, which British business doesn't have to that same extent.
That's right. And that is a particular benefit to certain sectors. So, for instance, in very advanced manufacturing and things like pharmaceuticals, there have been some very significant investments there. So there are very significant success stories in discrete areas like that. But those people are constrained again by the uncertainty and the instability that this has engendered in the situation in Northern Ireland. Because are you going to invest massively in a new plant in Northern Ireland if you think that this might be torn up in 3 or 4 years? Time. Some people are making those big investments, but others are holding back. They're not sure what's going to happen here.
Sam, do you have an instinct for how this will actually finally be settled?
One possibility for this continuing in a long-term scenario is with massive flexibility, where as Great Britain diverges, or as the EU diverges from Great Britain, however quickly that process happens, we are going to become further away from one or the other. And that, I think, is going to have implications for UK public policy. Every time a prime minister wants to change policy away from the EU, he's going to have to ask himself, can we do this in Northern Ireland under the protocol? If he can't, then either that means hardening the Irish Sea border, or it means scrapping that policy for the entire UK. So it's going to be a huge headache for the entire country.
Sam McBride. And from Belfast to Brussels. Never mind us, you might ask. How's it been for them, our former partners in the EU? To tell me, I'm joined by the BBC's Europe editor, Katja Adler. Katja Adler, as far as we can tell, what impact has the UK leaving the EU had on the European economy and European trade?
Well, the European Commission published a study in November to suggest that in the last 8 months, trade bounced back. So the EU as a whole says it's not really feeling the sting of Brexit. At the beginning of the year, it was very difficult to differentiate the difference between the effect of COVID and the COVID pandemic and of Brexit itself. Obviously, if you move in from the kind of broader EU picture, some countries are suffering more than others economically and in terms of trade. And obviously, those are the countries that are closest to the UK. So first and foremost, Ireland, but also Belgium, France, you know, particularly with dairy products, for example, that now there's more paperwork, but it also takes longer to transport. And therefore, you can spoil goods along the way.
Have there been any countries which have managed to benefit from the absence of Britain in the EU?
The Netherlands has benefited because when inside the European Union, the UK was seen as the country that rolled up its sleeves, that stopped having loads of cups of coffee and procrastinating amongst EU member states as they sort of mulled over whatever conundrum was in front of them. Particularly when it came to trade and competitiveness, everybody looked to the UK. And the Netherlands has tried to be a mini UK now, if you like. So you do see Netherlands sort of being there at the top table at some points with France and Germany. Also, when you look at freedom of movement and how many European students from mainland Europe would want to come and study in the UK, that's all become more complicated after Brexit. And so many are heading to the Netherlands, where, you know, there's that facility with the English language and a similar kind of business-minded, practical-minded attitude.
Would you say that the EU in general has become tighter since the UK's departure? In other words, less likely to fall apart, or just as vociferous as people were concerned that it was before 2016?
Yes, that idea of the domino effect, wasn't there? So after Brexit, you'd have Dexit with Dedland leaving, Polexit, Poland, Italexit, Italy. No, we're very far from that, David, actually, because inside the European Union, the UK was really admired and respected by many countries. I remember when I first started in watching European politics, that was back in the 90s. You know, people would look to the United Kingdom and say, wow, you really have a free press. You really can speak truth to power. They admired our parliament and the free press, if you like. And I think that the implosion that happened in UK society and politics after the Brexit vote really put people off. I would hear going to Denmark, for example, oh my gosh, if that's what happened to the UK and its system after Brexit, what would it do to us? And so this idea of we will leave the EU and everything will be better is something that the loudly Eurosceptic parties like Marine Le Pen in France, for example, or Matteo Salvini in Italy, they have had to back away from publicly at election time because the public are Brussels sceptic, but they are frightened of actually leaving the European Union.
Katja, finally, what do you think Europeans expect from the UK and the UK government in the future?
Trust is very low when it comes to post-Brexit relations. And you can see that, you know, most of the conversations the two sides have had since Brexit have been over conflict, issues of conflict. So if we take the example of the stresses and strains and pressure and fears about Russia at the moment in various parts of Europe, never mind the United States. Normally at times like that in Europe, you would expect to see quite a lot of shuttle diplomacy going on between Berlin, Paris and London at the very least. And actually that activity has been minimal now post-Brexit. Of course, the sides come together at NATO meetings, meetings of the G7, but this sort of behind the doors, what are you thinking? How should we act towards that? That's gone. And I think there is a real yawning absence of the EU having a UK policy post-Brexit or the UK having an EU policy post-Brexit.
Katja Adler. So that's Europe and Northern Ireland. What about the rest of the UK? What can we say we've learned about the impact of Brexit a year in? Joining me in the studio is Anand Menon, director at the independent research organisation UK in a Changing Europe, and down the line is Peter Foster, author of the Financial Times newsletter Britain After Brexit. Peter Foster, firstly, how far do you think we can separate the effects now of Brexit from the effects of the pandemic?
The pandemic has obviously muddied the data, particularly on trade, but you still can do some basic measurements. If you look at UK imports and exports to the EU between 2021 and 2018, which was the sort of last stable period before we got into transition periods, you can see exports were, you know, £1.2 billion lower in the quarter to October 21, imports £3.6 billion lower. There are also clever models. John Springford at the Centre for European Reform has done a model which looks at how the UK has performed against similar doppelganger economies that haven't experienced Brexit. And he's worked out, for example, that exports and imports with the EU are about 15% lower than they otherwise would have been, which is in line with the Office of Budget Responsibility's own estimates and forecasts. But clearly, there's lots of unknowns going forward, and the pandemic complicates things.
It sounds like imports have been impacted more than exports. Now, why would that be?
Well, the simple answer is we don't really know. It would seem to be the case that imports from the European Union have fallen quite fast, despite the fact that the UK government only at the start of this January began to impose a lot of the checks that the Trade and Cooperation Agreement call for. So it's our exports to the EU that have been hit first. Now, there's a lot of stuff we still don't know. For instance, if you're talking about the impact of the pandemic, we are still to witness, I think, the real impact of Brexit on services trade, simply because a lot of those people who travel to sell their wares, accountants, lawyers, heaven help us, even academics, aren't doing it because of the pandemic. But for the moment, the data, I think, is at best quite messy.
The import-export disparity, my kind of simplistic view of that was, oh, it's not so bad, really, because we don't want their imports and we want to export more. So if our imports have gone down more than our exports have gone down, that's good.
Well, I mean, yes, you hear that view a lot. It strikes me as a very, very simplistic way of viewing trade for several reasons. One, you might perhaps like French cheese or Austrian ham or whatever, and if the imports aren't coming in, you can't get them anymore. So in terms of consumer choice, there's something going on. But the second thing, of course, is that quite often imports are unfinished manufactured products that go into things that we make here. And if those imports start affecting manufacturing supply chains, it doesn't just mean that we're importing less. It means our ability to export those finished goods decreases as well.
Right. Peter Foster, I've heard the figure bandied around that we've lost 4% of GDP as a consequence of Brexit. Is there actually a ballpark figure like that which we can rely upon?
Well, that's an OBR, Office of Budget Responsibility figure, and it's their estimate of the long run impact of Brexit on the economy. So essentially, the economy will end up in the long run, over a 10-15 year period, 4% smaller than it otherwise would have been. And it's important to remember that no one lives the counterfactual. No one lives in that other economy that's 4% bigger. In essence, what you've done is you've put a massive layer of bureaucracy between the UK economy and the economies of the European Union, from which we get 50% of our imports and send 45-odd% of our exports. So one way to look at it is a European company that has a British supplier in its supply chain now has that supplier behind a wall of bureaucracy. But that company in the European Union has 26 other companies to choose from that are bureaucracy-free, whose stuff isn't going to get stuck at the docks. And when you multiply that over time, that fundamentally is the reason why, all things considered, when you wrap in other factors, services, etc., to a 4% long-run loss in GDP.
And Amenon, what do you think? The politics of this played into this. I think the language around cliff edge is coming back to haunt the Remain side now, in a sense, because it's not going to be a cliff edge. It's going to be like a slow economic puncture. It's going to take a while. What the OBR have said is about a quarter of that 4% has been felt to date.
Right.
And of course, that's got very much lost in the noise of the pandemic, which has been a far larger short-term hit.
Peter Foster, you've done a lot of work with companies in the UK looking at what the impact of Brexit has been, particularly with smaller and medium businesses. What kind of companies have done worse and why, and have any actually benefited?
The companies that have done worse are the smaller companies. They just have less bandwidth, less cash flow, less expertise to deal with all of the forms that are now involved in trading with Europe. The companies that have done better are those that are able to take advantage or suck up the market share that have been lost by the smaller companies. And interestingly, the politics around Brexit talked about unleashing the power of innovation and small business. But one of its effects, I suspect, will be that it will entrench the power of bigger businesses that have the capacity to deal with the grit we've now thrown in the wheels.
So let's come on to what you might call the vaccine paradigm, which is the kind of notion given weight by the experience of the vaccination programme, which is that Britain could use being outside the EU to be so nimble, to be so fleet of foot, as to reap significant advantages from divergence from the EU. Now, how far at the moment are we making use of that capability?
Well, the answer is not very far, but to be fair to the government, we are only 1 year out, and businesses work on much longer time horizons than that. You know, one of the fundamental problems with that sort of theory is that big companies and innovative companies that deal with high-tech products, whether it's chemicals or medical devices, whatever it might be, most of them trade with Europe. So ultimately, the extent to which those industries want divergence is kind of limited. I think where you might see a greater case for divergence is in future technologies. I don't know, you know, the city might regulate the trading of cryptocurrencies in a more laissez-faire way than the EU. Gene editing is another area where the UK might steal a march. But fundamentally, trade is global. And the two entities that set the regulatory weather are the United States and the European Union. And so you talk to a lot of companies, they don't want a bespoke UK regime because it frankly gets in the way.
And then, Menon, is that how you see it as well?
I think the big area is in new technologies, as Peter alluded to. So emergent areas of economic activity, whether it's fintech, whether it's nanotechnology, whether it's gene editing, there is, if we do it right, and that's a big if, the potential for us to benefit from a first mover advantage by regulating smartly and regulating quickly and thereby attracting inward investment in those sectors before the EU has really reacted.
I would just add, as Anand says, you know, if we do it right, and one of the downsides of the EU regulatory system, which covers 27 markets, is that it's slow and cumbersome. But the upside of that is it's very predictable. Companies know exactly where they stand. The UK has an option to regulate smarter than that, to regulate more nimbly than that. But the downside of that is that you get, you know, what people call a restless regulator, where the UK pinballs around for political reasons and actually creates more of a headache than an upside.
Okay, let's move on to trade deals. What's the record so far, Alan?
What we've done first and foremost is we've sort of rolled over the agreements that the European Union had with a host of third countries. So we've maintained the status quo, which I suppose is no mean feat, because there was absolutely no reason why some of those countries couldn't turn around to us and say, hang on a sec, you're a far smaller market now. We want better terms. We've managed to sort of fight that off. We've signed, or at least agreed, a trade deal with Australia that will have a minuscule impact in terms of GDP, opens up some areas such as agriculture, with potential domestic costs, is worth saying. On the international front, yeah, progress has been limited. I mean, we've had very little in the way of a foreign policy for quite a time now.
Let's look at labour market and migration. What can we say have been the effects, and what do we imagine the effects will be?
Well, clearly, in terms of immigration, COVID has muddied the waters massively. But there's a couple of interesting observations we can make about Brexit and immigration, I think. The first is, this is clearly the area so far where we have exercised our newfound independence. We have a new immigration policy, and that immigration policy is already having an impact. We see it in the increase in the number of non-EU migrants coming to the UK. We see it, for instance, in a massive increase in the number of Indian students coming to UK universities at the moment, partly because of the provision that allows them to stay and work for a couple of years after they finish their studies. So what we have actually in terms of the rest of the world is probably a more liberal immigration policy than many people might have expected.
Peter.
So there are now about 1 million vacancies in the UK job market, according to the Office of National Statistics. And part of that is as a result of Brexit. So during the pandemic, about 1.3 million European workers, many of whom had settled status, so they had the right to remain in the UK, went back home for obvious reasons. They want to go back home, and lots of them haven't come back. And because now low-skilled immigration is not allowed from Europe, apart from a few exemptions, it's become much harder for industries like hospitality and social care to recruit from Europe. Now, the government is adamant that it wants business to adjust. It wants British business to train more British workers, but there are only a finite numbers of workers. And if you can't get workers, it's tough to grow your business.
Well, let me be clear about this. Does that mean that we are not replacing people of working age who come here to work, who used to come from the EU, with people from other countries? And
no, people are coming here to work if they meet the skills and salary criteria set out in our points-based system. But what we lose with free movement is flexibility. Flexibility in the sense that employers can turn to the European market when they're short and get people in. With the best will in the world, it's hard to imagine someone from India popping over here for 3 months to pick soft fruit in the summer, then going home again. It was quite easy to imagine someone from continental Europe doing that.
Are you saying that Britain may have taken back control of its migration policy, but businesses have less control now of their capacity to bring in labour?
Yeah, there's far less flexibility for businesses now to bring in the labour they want at the time they want. And both the opportunity and the disadvantage of freedom of movement was it was outside the control of government.
Right. OK, let's talk about a bit now about unintended consequences. In other words, things that we've learned in the course of the last year or so about Brexit that we maybe didn't factor in before.
I'd say two things. The first is that the Eurosceptics were right, that the European Union had sort of inveigled its way into every aspect of national life, which it was why it is so hard to leave. But secondly, in a sense, what difference the European Union made to the constitutional order of the United Kingdom. And by that I mean, when we were part of the European Union, we lived under some rules, EU rules, that Parliament couldn't touch by itself. Now, everything is up for grabs. There's no such thing, in a sense, as enshrined rights in terms of environmental standards or employment standards, because anything can be changed at the behest of Parliament.
In other words, it's a question mark as to whether we have lost a straitjacket or lost a framework.
Precisely, yeah.
Peter Foster, where do you think we are beginning to emerge on this question of what kind of Britain we're going to be outside of the European Union? I mean, there are several different versions of it, one of which was the famous Singapore upon Thames, the massively deregulated country, which was incredibly agile. Where are we going on that?
The trouble is that we have less choice over the shape of Brexit than we might imagine, because companies need to trade, they need to engage in global markets, they need to have, you know, regulatory environments that work in a globalised economy.
Anna Menon, what kind of Brexit are we heading for?
This is the answer you love. It's far, far too early to say. I mean, it depends on the politics, doesn't it? At the moment, we have a Conservative Party deeply divided inside itself between those sort of traditional Conservatives who think, let's slash and burn regulation. And you've got these red wall MPs who are saying, hang on a sec, actually what my constituents want is not lower worker protections, it is greater state intervention, it is more investment, it is better infrastructure. So at the moment, there's a sort of stalemate in the heart of the governing party, but how it goes is going to be up to our politics, ultimately.
That was Anna Menon with Peter Foster. And what do I glean from all that? That for now, the post-Brexit uplands are probably fairly low and rather cloudy. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Kirstine Knight, Ben Henderson, Ben Carter and Rosamund Jones. The programme was mixed by Neil Churchill and the editor was Richard Barden. If you enjoyed it, you may find other episodes interesting, including Could There Be War in Ukraine? What Are the Laws in Space? And What Next for Afghanistan? You can find them all on BBC Sounds.
Beating climate change is a tough job, but we've got a famously tough guy on our side.
I think that we have to go and button up and work together in order to really conquer this problem.
39 Ways to Save the Planet is the podcast from BBC Radio 4 that meets the sharpest brains with the best ideas to cut the carbon. And it's a podcast with a famous fan, Arnold Schwarzenegger.
One of my favorite chapters was when you talked about the things that we can do right away. The nuclear power, when you talk about the smaller reactors, or for instance, the dry rice, or you know the carbon capturing, and all of those kind of things. There's so many things that we can do technologically.
If you want to hear more from Arnie and a host of inspiring innovators all taking the fight to climate change, then subscribe to 39 Ways to Save the Planet on BBC Sounds.
We've terminated problems in the past. I think that we can do it again. It's the bottom line.